Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Can you hear me?
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show right here on the Seika Network, right here on blogtalkradio.com. I'm Rosita DeJesus, and I'm joined with my co-host and brother in the martial arts, Sifu Robert Deal. Sifu Bob, how you doing this evening?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. You know, I'm really excited about tonight's show. I never hear this kind of show done.
Yeah, it's... it's
the comparisons and similarities and... I think it truly seems like it's something that's overlooked in the arts, because you're right. You posted something this week that says there's only so many ways someone can move their body.
That's right. That's right. There's only so many ways, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have a show like this, is that I know that all of our other guests that are now currently online, and we're going to go ahead and introduce you guys here in just a sec, but I know that all of our guests here on the line right now have either met people that have placed a big, like, separative fence between themselves and other arts, or between themselves and other, like, arts from other countries, I guess I should say. In this case, it would be Eastern countries and Southeast Asian countries with Western countries. You know, I've heard everything that ran the gamut from, you know, people claiming that their art is the best for self-defense, or on and on and on. I've had people, you know, be passive aggressive with me, you know, and say something like, well, you know, just because there are other arts that are more effective, there's no reason why we can't learn from them. And I'm thinking, what the heck are you talking about? You just said, you're just implying that your art was better than mine. When you know, there is no better, there's only better people. And that's the way I look at it. So, and I figured, what better way to discuss all this than having a bunch of Eastern martial artists talking with Western martial artists. So that's the subject of our show, listeners, the similarities and differences between Eastern and Western martial arts. So our number here is 347-677-0699. So call in to be part of the discussion, or if you have any questions for any of our guests. We've also got our chat board up, and if you're listening live on Blog Talk Radio, you scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll see the chat board. And it's live now, and it looks like we already have 5 guests online on the chat board already. So pretty cool. So 347-677-0699. So let's go ahead and start with first introducing our guests. So Bob, would you do me the honors of introducing our first 2 guests?
Well, our first 2 guests, our first guest is Tim Wesky. I've known Tim for about 25 years. I studied fencing with him, taught a couple classes, and was teaching kickboxing out of his Burbank studio many, many, many years ago when I still had hair. So you know that was a while ago. Since you and I haven't discussed this so, Rusty, do you want him to talk about the background and then go on to the next guest as an introduction?
Actually, let's introduce everyone first, and then I'd like to go back and have everyone give a short bio on themselves. So we've got Mr. Tim Wesky. Welcome, Mr. Tim. How you doing?
Hey, where's the applause? Where's the applause, Rusty?
Right there.
There it is.
I got your back,
guest,
Bob.
I know you do, always. Our next guest is I've known for a few years. Him and I were part of the Masters Hall of Fame together. Inducted, I believe we were inducted the same year, as a matter of fact, Mr. Craig Carter, which is going to represent the Korean arts of, you know, Taekwondo, Hapkido, and he also does Yeti Padre Eskrima, and Wado from the Japanese side, so he'll give us a large mixture of different styles.
Right on. Welcome, Master Craig.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Yay. All right. And I'd like to introduce the next two guests. I'd like to bring online here Mr. Cecil Longino. He is an instructor and owner, if I remember correctly, one of the owners of the South St. George here in Seattle, Washington. And he's been teaching fencing, historical fencing, for I don't know how long. How long, Cecil?
Well, the school's been around for about 10 years now.
Oh, okay. So a decade. So welcome, welcome. And I can't find the applause. So, no, here we go.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to bring on another member of the South St. George. This is Ms. Stephanie Zimmerman, who has been a student since 2003. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Oh, whew, good. I thought my brain was leaving me for a second. I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot when she joined the school. So welcome aboard. Yep. And again, these two are representing historical and classical fencing. Let's go back a little bit and let's go to Mr. Weske. And
yes,
if we could take turns, all of us, and just kind of give our listeners just a very brief overview of our experience. So we'll start with Mr. Weske.
Sure. I've been instructing fencing, competitive fencing, for about 30 years. Done a number of television shows and movies. Trained a lot of celebrities in the movie industry. And basically what I've done is taken competitive fencing, classical fencing, whatever, and all that stuff, and theatrical movie stuff, and made a mixture and so that when you see something, television show, it's what it should have been like, instead of, you know, just the old click-clack type of feel that a lot of the things are.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. Teaching people in competitive, done competitive fencing, and taught a lot of competitors, made Bob lose his hair.
I thought that was my kid.
One of them?
Both of them.
Children? I'm both of them.
Yes, children.
So that's kind of, in a nutshell, my experience.
Alrighty.
I own a studio for 21 years now, called Swordplay in Burbank, California. Swordplay LA in Burbank, California.
Very cool. Thank you.
Very
for
cool.
That brief background. Master Craig, we'll go to you.
Yes, dear. Well, I've had the experience of training under some of the best Japanese and Korean masters, and for, let's see, I've got about 35, 36 years in, and I have about 22 years teaching various spots all over the country, and I've been privileged to work and train with people like Sifu Bob there with you and yourself, and I've been very blessed to get a good wide variety of martial arts training.
Right on. Thank you so much, Master Craig. And let's go to Mr. Longino. Can you give us a brief synopsis of your martial arts experience?
Oh, of course, Rusty. The first thing I would like to say is that in my early teens, I began training in Taekwondo with Grandmaster Cho.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Oklahoma. But if you can cut out the part where I actually lived in Oklahoma, that would be great. from that early age, I think the most important thing that I actually learned from him is that he was very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And that I never realized until much later in my life is that his approach to martial arts in that traditional manner sort of informed what I kept looking for years later.
Mm-hmm.
Where the training was very strict, and you were expected to do things correctly,
right?
And do as you were instructed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I'm just going to jump ahead, because anything else I did after that is sort of insignificant until 2000, when I began taking classes from Maestro Ramon Martinez in New York. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of one of the few remaining classical fencing masters that are still teaching. And so I started training, taking classes from him in 2000, and then in 2003 I became an official student of his in 2003. Mm-hmm. And then after that in 2007, I became an instructor with the Martinez Academy in New York.
Right on. And
very cool.
That is very cool. And let's move on to Ms. Zimmerman. Stephanie, what's your brief synopsis of your experience?
Well, my mom enrolled me in some judo classes when I was in first grade. That lasted all of about 8 days before a third grader fell on me and broke my arm, at which point I realized that maybe I should be a tool user.
Wait a minute, hold on. Okay, I'm sorry. To be a tool user.
She's going to cough up a lung.
She gets a rim shot. Okay, so after judo and a broken arm.
Fast forward to college. There was some fencing classes that were available for a few years by some talented people who were there briefly. And I took that and really, really loved the classes, but I didn't particularly care for the club so much because there's a lot more chaos in the club environment than naturally you would find in the class environment. And then after leaving that, I eventually came to Seattle and dabbled with a number of things that didn't really call out to me so much. And then I saw an ad for one of the classes that Cecil here was offering, and I took that class and I've been training with the system that he's teaching ever since. And there's something particularly about it that is appealing to me, and as attested by some of the obsessive compulsive natures of some of the other students in the school to really help generate the community that's part of the whole experience.
Awesome. Thank you, Stephanie. And let's go ahead and, Bob, how about you and I just do a brief synopsis, too, so that way all our listeners kind of know where we're all coming from. So I'll go ahead and start. Started martial arts when I was about 8. So it's been about 37, 38 years. I've got certifications in Butokukan Karate, Kajikembo, Doce Pares Escrima, the Kakoi Kenyete lineage of Escrito and Pangamot. What else? Qigong, Kudo, a little bit of Baguazhang, a little bit of Xingyi, but I'm not like certified in those. Wushu, but I'm not jumping around anymore. I'm pretty much just doing Tai Chi. So I'll be representing not only the Japanese martial arts, but the Chinese and Southeast Asian martial arts. So, Bob?
Okay, well, like so many youngsters, I started Taekwondo at a very young age. Opened up a business with my father in Simi Valley and met one of my first Wing Chun instructors, which was also certified in Okinawan Tai Karate under Grandmaster Gordon DiVersola. So I studied with him for years and years through Wing Chun, through Okinawan Tai. Then through him, I met at a Randy Williams seminar, I met Mark Stewart, which took me on to my JKD, my Kali, my Muay Thai, my Savant. And like you, getting older, blowing out my back, my leg doesn't go up like it used to.
Right.
It doesn't matter how much I open up my hips, they just don't go there anymore. You know, from then I studied with Ted Lukai Lukai every Saturday. I taught various schools throughout Southern California. I was traveling with Mark Stewart, who's sort of his uki, in many seminars in Reno, San Francisco, San Diego. I can't even think of the others. Like it was outside Solvang, which is by Santa Barbara. And I was his test crash dummy for a while. That's my little bit of experience. And of course I taught at Tim's swordplay school. I taught kickboxing there for about a year or so.
Very cool. So
that's about it. And we're in the same boat. We're sort of going to both represent the, the Asian, the Chinese influences.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the Dynamic Dojo Radio Show, and our open forum subject today is the differences and similarities between Eastern and Western martial arts. Feel free to join in on the conversation, 347-677-0699. That's our guest call-in, or we've got our chat board. We have several people on chat, but no one wants to talk. Come on, folks, we'll give you a shout-out. Chat on the chat board or call in. All right. So now that we have everyone on board, all of our guests on board, and we've given the listeners just a brief overview on our experience and what the side of the pond we're going to be representing, let's move on to our announcements and news for the week. So, Bob, you sent me some news for Facebook shout-outs, and I'm finding
right,
it.
I sent you three.
Oh, here we go. I
okay,
found
got it.
I found
it. Oh, cool. Now, yeah, there was that last one. I wasn't sure if you could read or not, but it's on our Facebook page.
Yeah, yeah. So well, let's start with the first one. These particular events are put on our Dynamic Dojo Facebook page. So if there are any listeners out there that like this show and you want to follow the show, feel free to look up Dynamic Dojo group page on Facebook and join in, and you'll be able to get all the cool news and events and upcoming episodes and stuff. But here are a few announcements from the page. It looks like there's going to be a seminar in Elizabeth, New Jersey. This is the first annual Grandmaster Billy Davis Memorial Workshop. It's going to be February 24th, 2013 in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And I know that we're posting this up with the announcement kind of early, but we're going to continue to announce this in previous episodes until the workshop. So again, the first annual Grandmaster Billy Davis Memorial Workshop, it's open to brown and black belts that want to add jujitsu to their school or earn certification in combat jujitsu. And the featured instructors at this particular workshop are going to be Soke Hassan Kalik. He's the president of the family of Sanukis, the Sanukis Ru system founded by Dr. Moses Powell. We also have an instructor from the African martial arts, Mfundishi Khalil Maasi, from the Maasi family system. And Mr. Maasi is the son of Shaha Mfundishi Maasi, a top student of Dr. Myongyi. I think I said that wrong. So, Mr. Maasi, if I said that wrong, just please call me and slap me in the head. We also have Soke Glenn Perry, who is the inheritor of the Black Dragon Aikijutsu under Shidoshi Ron Van Cleef. We have at this workshop also Hanshi Stephen Elmore. He's the inheritor of his grandfather's Aki Elmore Ru Jiu-Jitsu system in, I'm assuming it says New York City because it says NYC. And we also have Grandmaster Daryl Sargent, who happens to be the host of Modern Combat Masters, another show here on Blog Talk Radio that I co-host for. Grandmaster Daryl Sargent is the inheritor of the Davis Jiu-Jitsu Self-Defense System and the vice president of the family of Sanukis and the founder of the Silent Warrior Arts Kali Silat School. So if anyone wants any information about the Grandmaster Billy Davis Memorial Workshop, it's going to be a lot of cool classes going on. It goes from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. February 24th, 2013. You can email, and if anyone has a pen or paper, if anyone's interested, you can email FOSVP, that's FOSVP, 2012-2012, so FOSVP2012 at gmail.com, or you can contact Grandmaster Daryl Sargent himself at area code 405-626-5171. So,
wow, see,
that's
well, I was going to say, I was impressed that you got all those names right. Until you started stumbling and apologizing, nobody would have known.
Yeah, that's true, but I was present for all these people's interviews. So it's like,
oh, you cheated. I got it.
Yeah, I was present for all these people's interviews, and I'm still having trouble with the title Mfundishi. I don't know if it's Mfundishi or umfundishi with a, you know, with a glottal stop or anything. So, I don't know. All right, let's move on to the next news bit here. We've got Elaine Yamano had written our group page and wanted to put out this announcement about her third annual Yukon Na Samurai event in Laughlin, Nevada, and that's on July 13th, 2013, at the River Palms Hotel and Casino. Now, she says that if you pre-register by June 13th, you'll be entered to win a two-night stay at the River Palms and dinner for two at The Lodge, which is their fine dining restaurant. This Yukon Na Samurai event is a tournament, and it's open to all styles and ages. There are grand championship divisions for junior black belt and brown belt forms, adult black belt forms and weapons, and adult black belt sparring. She wants to add that the rooms are affordable at the River Palms Hotel and Casino, as well as the tournament. there's no other information except for if you do want any information about competing at this tournament, if you happen to be in the Laughlin, Nevada area. Let's see, NV, that's Nevada, right? NV?
That's correct.
Okay. You can contact Elaine Yamano at ysrk@dzw.blackberry.net. Let me say that again.
Would you please?
Yeah, that's a lot. It just looked like a strange format for an email address, but it's probably a BlackBerry address. So, ysrk@vzw.blackberry.net, or which is even easier to write down, her direct phone number, 951-264-8493. You can contact her via email or phone about the Yukon Na Samurai tournament in Laughlin, Nevada. So very cool. All right. And lastly, on our events shout-outs, this is from Master Douglas Wong. And he says that his son is hosting this really cool event at a new studio that he helped put together called JAM, and it's an acronym for Joining All Movement. And this particular event is they're calling it the JAM 2013 Winter Gathering, but it's more of like a winter tricking gathering. Now, for anyone that doesn't know what tricking is, how do I explain it? It's like extreme martial arts on steroids. So, you know, all the, you know, fancy acrobatics and crazy jumps and stuff like that. And it's turned into a great sport, and they call it tricking. It actually has a lot of martial art influence in it. But if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, they deemed it tricking so that way they wouldn't get any backlash from actual martial artists. Now, some people that actually do tricking have very little or no martial arts experience at all, or they are very accomplished martial artists with, you know, anywhere between 10 to 15 years of martial arts, serious martial arts training under their belt, and they do this tricking type of activity. Number one, because they can, because they're young, and number two, because mm-hmm. it's a challenge. Right. So, you know, if I would have known that tricking existed, if it existed when I was around 14, I would have been doing it. But I did wushu, so that's just about the same. I can't move anything now because of my wushu. But some of these guys are incredible, like crazy incredible. So if anyone out there listening has never heard of it, just go to YouTube and look up tricking martial arts or just tricking. You'll see some crazy stuff. It's really cool. But anyway, this JAM gathering is happening on January 5th, 2013. And it's at the JAM gym facility. Say that 10 times fast. JAM gym facility. I had a hard enough time saying it once. And this is in... Okay, now how do you guys say this? Is it Reseda.
Reseda.
Okay, so that's kind of like how everyone says my name when they first meet me. And I have to go, no, there's a T there.
Yeah, Reseda D. Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. That's what everyone does. Like they assume it's like R-E-S-E-T-A or R-E-S-E-D-A or whatever. So Reseda, that sounds so weird for me to say that. Reseda, California.
I know, that almost sounded like an Aretha Franklin song.
R-E-S-E-D-A. Oh, gosh. So the Jam Gym is at 18242 Sherman Way in Reseda, California, 91335. It's a huge facility. This is a 9,500-square-foot facility. And anything that you want in this studio, they've got. They've got a Palmer spring floor, a high-density rubber training floor, a regular wooden training floor if you're doing, like, karate or something. They've got a 22-foot-long foam pit with acrobatic runways and trampoline entrances and Aussie string bed trampoline. They've got parkour and free running sections, climbing ropes, heavy bags, a thing called an air trick. I have no idea what an air trick is, but the studio is amazing. And in this 95,000 square feet or 9,500 square foot facility, they teach not only tricking, but parkour, White Lotus Kung Fu, Tai Chi, and Qigong. So it isn't just a tricking school. They do teach real martial arts there as well. But so I just wanted to put that out there and promote Master Wong's event for that. So, woohoo!
Cool.
And that's it for our Facebook shout-outs. Whew. Now what?
Yeah,
oh,
I put out
news.
The announcement today. If you got anything going, tell us about it. And all of a sudden, we'd get hit.
Yeah.
We've never gotten hit like that before.
Well, see, now you know the secret, Bob. You put it out there the day prior our show. Because every time I put out something like a week in advance, nobody takes me up on it. So, trying to make our listeners feel guilty.
good. Good job.
No. Yeah. If you have any events, anybody, and that includes our Western martial arts friends. If you have any event, we support you. We're gonna go ahead and announce it. All right, so let's move on to our health news. Now, I actually had an interesting health news story, but then I realized I didn't want to go too far into our open forum time. So instead, what I'd like to do is offer up just a couple questions on the weekly health quiz that's presented in the New York Times. So, and it would be cool if Master Craig and Mr. Wesky and Cecil and Stephanie and Bob could join me in on this because you guys get to help answer. You guys get to guess. All right? All right.
Okay, got it.
So let me turn off my phone here real quick. It's like everyone knows I'm broadcasting right now. Why are they calling me? I don't know. Okay, so question number one, okay? Researchers in Seattle who watched more than 1,100 pedestrians cross the street found that people texting were how much likelier to engage in unsafe behavior, like disobeying the lights or crossing mid-block. Is it 2 times as likely, 4 times as likely, 7 times as likely, or 10 times as likely? What do you guys guess?
Are we talking about you, Stephen?
Let's all talk at once.
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I was texting. What was that?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
Based off Reseda, I would have to say 10 times more likely.
Nice. He already has your number.
Yeah, he gets this too. All right. Guesses. So that was Craig. That guessed 10 times as likely.
I'm guessing
Steph?
7, Rusty.
Okay, you're guessing 7? Steph?
7 is probably the answer, but I'll guess 10.
Okay, 10. And Stephanie.
Oh yeah, I'm all in for 10.
Oh, you're all in for 10. And is Stephanie still texting?
Yeah.
What? What? Oh my God! And she's walking. No, don't let that happen.
No. I'm playing solitaire.
Oh. All right. Well, so we have a couple votes for 7 and a couple votes for 10. It's actually 4 times. 4 times as likely.
So out of all those people,
wow,
they didn't see you cross the street once?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know what they were. It makes me wonder what they were considering unsafe behavior. So if they were just counting disobeying the light, you know, like walking just before it turns into the walk sign or crossing mid-block, then I can see the 4 times as likely. But, you know, if there's anything I hate, it's people that are walking across the street and they're texting and then they decide to, like, walk diagonally down the street. So that way it gives them a head start down the sidewalk and you can't turn right when they're crossing because they're walking down the freaking street. It's like, I would count that as unsafe.
The scariest part of that is that somebody actually got paid to watch people text and walk across the street.
I know.
That's right. They must be a city employee.
They either have to have a city employee or, I don't know, maybe they disguised it as, hey, you know, we'll pay you like $100 if you sit in this duck blind and watch people cross Third Avenue.
Wow.
I don't know. Yeah.
No, actually, the scariest part is I have to drive around these people.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Oh, my gosh. And the one time I honked at someone that was texting when they were crossing the street and walking diagonally down the street so I couldn't cross, the guy stopped and slammed his hand on my car. And I went, you know, I'm not going to get out because that would be stupid. You know? I'm like, oh, my gosh. All right. So let's move on to the next question. Olympic athletes live on an average 2.8 years longer than the rest of us. In which of the following sports did athletes tend to live longest according to two new analyses? Is it bobsledding, the hammer throw, weightlifting, or croquet?
Cricket.
Croquet, okay, yeah.
Badminton. Okay.
Badminton? Well, our choices
well,
that's
two,
are.
Well, two texting again.
Oh.
Any other guesses? So we have a guess for croquet. Steph, Cecil?
Bobsledding,
okay.
It's all guesswork at this point. No idea.
Curling. How about curling?
Bobsledding from curling?
Jamaica.
It's, I had to actually look this up because I was like, you got to be kidding. It's croquet. Out of those choices, it's croquet. Who snorted? I mean, back there. It's croquet. and the premise behind this is, It says that in general, the researchers found that Olympic medalists lived an average of 2.8 years longer than their age-matched peers. More specifically, 8% more of the medalists than non-Olympians were still living 30 years after they had won their medal. But there were differences in regards to the type of sport. So, like the medalists in endurance sports, like marathon running and cycling, and in mixed sports that involve technique as well as exertion, like cricket, golf, and croquet, and I didn't know that they all were once Olympic sports, that they shared similarly extended lifespan. So about 13% more of them were alive 30 years later after their Olympic success than their non-Olympian counterparts. So and according to the research also, it says that medalists in the power sports, like weightlifting and the hammer throw, were not as long-lived. Only about 5% of them were still alive after 30 years after their wins than non-Olympians of the same age. So, wow, pretty wild.
I got a question for you.
Sure.
I got a question, Rosita. Does that apply to people that play those sports that aren't Olympians?
You know, see, that's what I was wondering too, right? And it doesn't say here on the research whether or not it applied to non-Olympians, But I would imagine that I think they were only focusing on the Olympians because of, I guess, the more practice that they've put in as opposed to recreational. So, but
what if they don't? What if they don't have your sport in the Olympics yet?
I don't know. I would love to have wushu or tai chi in there. Now, is it taekwondo still in the Olympic sport though?
Taekwondo is, but it's specialized rules to showcase the signature, whereas, say, karate is not. Well, it is recognized it is not a medal sport, so they can't go compete.
Right. Yeah, when we were petitioning to have wushu added as an Olympic sport, we were really pushing for the 2008 Olympics when they were in Beijing. And unfortunately, the Olympic Committee nixed that. They said nope. And the reason was that apparently not every country has people that do wushu. And I didn't know that that was a requirement, that every country has to have a, you know, a body of practitioners. And I
last time I checked, not everybody bobsleds.
Yeah, right? So,
but there's Jamaica. They do in Jamaica.
Yes, they do. Now.
Yes, they do. So, yeah, yep. I thought that was really kind of weird. What was that?
What about curling? Not everyone does curling or even heard of it.
Yeah, I don't know. So, but yeah, apparently
I do a lot of curling. It just happens to have a beer in it. It's a beer in my hand at the same time.
Well, look at the sport. I swear that was designed in a pub.
I would imagine so. I'd love to learn curling. I mean, there's a curling club out here, and I'd love to learn curling. A couple of my friends went to go curling, and they're like, oh, my God, you do Tai Chi. You would so love this. And I'm like, yeah, really? Okay, I'll give it a shot. So one of these days I'm going to give it a shot and try it. I'd really love to learn it. But yeah, you know, I thought the same thing, Craig, as far as, like, you know, why weren't there studies done, you know, in relation to the non-Olympians, you know? But again, you know, I'm guessing that they just focus on the Olympians because of the more rigorous practice schedule, I would guess. So there you go. Pretty wild, huh? All right, last question for our health quiz. A large observational study found that people who drank 4 to 6 cups of coffee daily were less likely to die of what condition? Is it type 1 diabetes? Is it an aneurysm? Is it oral cancer, or is it cardiac arrest?
Oversleeping.
Type 1 diabetes.
Type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, I agree with Craig. Type 1 diabetes.
Okay. And Cecil, you said sleeping? Oh, diabetes.
Correct.
Okay. And Steph, what's your guess?
I was thinking narcolepsy was there too, so.
Sorry. And Steph, what about you? What's your guess? Cardiac arrest? Huh?
No, I would say heart disease.
Heart disease, okay. Well, actually, you guys, the answer is oral cancer. So if you drink coffee like we do here in Seattle, drinking lots of coffee is associated with a reduced risk of death from oral cancer. So,
wow.
Weird,
what a
huh?
dilemma.
I know. I mean, why can't it be beer?
Well, I'm just concerned. Does that mean if they have a cup of coffee with their cigarette, they negate the problem?
Exactly. I've got a cigar in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. I'm good.
I know, right? Yeah, like a cigarette, you know, or, you know, if I have a snooze in my lip and I'm drinking the coffee, is that going to mess it up? I mean,
well,
I don't get it.
That's like so many problems.
What was that, Steph? What?
It's like drinking Diet Coke.
Ew.
Yes.
with a cheeseburger.
Well, right?
Yeah. So apparently, it says here that the researchers found that the risk of death from oral or throat cancer was 26% lower among those who drank only one cup a day. 33% lower than those who drank 2 to 3 cups a day and 50% lower than those who drank 4 to 6 cups a day compared with those who drank no caffeinated coffee. And there was a barely significant association of decaf with reduced risk and no link at all to tea. So, and apparently this report, this study was posted online this month in the American Journal of Epidemiology. There we go. God.
There it is.
Jeez.
I'm just curious. Was this sponsored by Seattle?
No, let me see where this
just has Starbucks written all over it.
Yeah, I know, right? This was on the New York Times. So, and the study was actually done in, let me see here. No, it just says that the study was posted at the American Journal of Epidemiology. Yeah, it doesn't say where the study was done, but there's like a whole bunch of hyperlinks that probably link to the actual study. So, but there we go. There's our health quiz. So all the facts that you probably would have never wanted to guess at. So, all right. Well, we are at the weird news. This is Bob's section. This is the weird news. News of the weird. So. Off to you, Bob.
And I did pick a short story because, like yourself, I didn't want to cut too much into our forum time.
Right.
Plastic surgeons in Turkey and France told CNN in November that mustache implants have suddenly surged in popularity as Middle Eastern men use their increased bushiness to convey power and prestige. go on to the next page. What they do is they extract follicles from hairier parts of the body and put it into the gentleman's lip. And the procedure costs about $7,000 and shows full results in about 6 months. An anthropology professor told CNN that by tradition in Arab countries, a man of honor would swear on my mustache, use mustaches as collateral for loans.
Whoa.
Shave off a if they get in a fight, they'll shave off their opponent's mustache if they win the fight.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Wow. So mustache
implants, and if they're really upset at somebody, they'll use a term like curse be upon your mustache. That seems so weird. This is why this was under weird news, that Middle Eastern guys, that I knew a guy that was of Greek descent, he told me he had to shave twice a day.
Oh, wow.
You figure these guys from these countries just grow hair naturally, not pay $7,000 for a doctor to shove more hair in their lip.
Right.
Now, let's move on to weird laws. I love weird laws. Weird laws are so cool.
We love the weird laws. Let's do the weird laws.
Love the weird laws. These are all from Colorado.
Okay.
In Denver, if a pet cat is loose on the streets, they have to wear a tail light.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
In Denver, the same city, it's illegal to mistreat rats. What are we supposed to do with rats?
Rats?
I hate rats. Mistreat rats.
So if you kick a rat and a cop catches you, right?
You go to jail.
Oh, suck.
In Pueblo, Colorado, a dandelion, and I don't know how they control this, a dandelion may not grow within the city limits.
Well, that sucks.
In the state of Colorado, it is unlawful to lend your vacuum to your next door neighbor.
Boy, aren't we glad we're not living in Colorado.
No doubt. And you know how snowy it gets in Denver? Mile High City gets a lot of white powder. It's illegal within Denver city limits to have a snowball fight.
Oh, man, see. Now that's stupid.
That's totally stupid.
That's completely wrong.
What?
Yeah.
That is completely wrong. Those kids must be bummed.
I know,
what
right?
What is our trivia question this week?
Oh, it's that time. It's our trivia
of the week. It's that time again.
It is. It's our trivia of the week. And for our listeners who don't know about it, we have a weekly trivia question of the week. And if you're listening live, if you have the first, if you're the first caller with the first correct answer, you get bragging rights and you get to be a guest host with me and Sifu Bob in an upcoming show. I do plan on getting different prizes, but for right now, it's you get to be a co-host with us for an upcoming show if you're the first correct answer and you call in. So our phone number here is 347-677-0699. So here is our trivia question of the week. So Betty Davis made her film debut in what film? Again, Betty Davis made her film debut in what film? If you're the first caller with the first right answer, you get to win a chance to be a guest co-host with me and Sifu Bob. Maybe that's why people haven't been calling. What do you think, Bob? They don't want to be with the weirdo.
I think you might have a point.
So 347-677-0699. All right. So that's our trivia question of the week, and that's it for our weird news and our health news bits and announcements. Let's go ahead and just take just a one-minute break for a quick PSA, and then we're going to go ahead and start with our discussion with our guests, Tim Weske, Craig Carter, Cecil Longino, and Stephanie Zimmerman. So let's just hang on for one sec as we get a word from the Ad Council.
Some statistics are surprising. Some are unbelievable. And some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%. And that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org. and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
And now, on with the show.
All right, we are back with the Dynamic Dojo radio show. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to an open forum regarding the differences and similarities between Eastern martial arts and Western martial arts. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments and would like to join in on the discussion, our number here is 347-677-0699. We also have our chat board up, so if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, go ahead and type them in the chat board there. I can see them. It's right on my board right now. Then we'll get to your questions. All right. So, like I said at the beginning of the show, the reason why I wanted to do a show like this was because, you know, sometimes there is a separation between martial arts, not only within Asian martial arts, right, and not only within styles. Like, you know, one style of karate might say, oh, you know, my style is better than your style of karate or something like that. But you know, sometimes I've run across people that see too many differences between, like in this case, Eastern martial arts and Western martial arts. That you know, and I don't know if it's because of, you know, stereotypes that each side might have of what the other art's all about or what. So that's why I wanted to do a show like this and have representatives from the East and West martial arts to represent their own martial arts and you know, let's discuss the training methods, the similarities, the differences of such, the philosophies, techniques, and so on. So now one of the things that I like to tell my students is that there's only so many ways the human body can move. And I'm a firm believer that all fighting systems will have its common threads. The only difference being probably the terminology or the technique, the style or the types of training methods. And, you know, considering that this show isn't so much about which system is best, but rather, you know, what the similarities and differences are, you know, I just want to throw this question out to all of our guests, and we'll all take turns answering it, okay? so my first question that I'd like to start off this discussion is even within the Asian arts, there are arguments about which art is considered, quote-unquote, more effective. And, you know, even within the Asian arts, some of these arguments are about as weak as the arts that they you know, seem to point fingers at, you know. So, you know, what do you see that kind of separation of sorts? Do you guys see it also between Eastern and Western, or even within just the Western martial arts or just the Asian martial arts? So you guys can just start talking whenever. So do you guys see any separation right now, let's just say, within, let's talk to the Western martial artists. Do you guys see any, you know, pointing fingers, separation, or my style's better than yours, or what, do you guys see any of that within the Western martial arts community?
In fencing, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one from coach to coach. Yeah,
well, why,
absolutely.
So why would that be, as far as, like, you know, coach to coach?
I don't know. It's I suppose it's an ego trip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't tell you. It's strange because, you know, when I compare the Eastern and the Western, there's a ton of similarities. The biggest similarity or the biggest difference, obviously, is that we have a weapon. We do it 6 feet apart from each other, so the distance is different, and therefore, you know, the philosophy as to how to touch the opponent is a bit different. However,
mm-hmm.
it's the same once it gets to that point of impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you're dealing with distances and footworks and reactions and trying to bait your opponent, or, you know, what you're looking for as far as you know, as far as what they do incorrectly, or what they do as far as what you want them to do, and you can reach out and get them or hit them with your sword, you know, it's pretty much the same. You know, yours is the Eastern is just closer as
mm-hmm.
far as, you know, balances and things a little bit. But then again, you're dealing with different weapons when you're dealing with your legs and your hands than
mm-hmm.
with a. So, but yeah, within the community, there's all kinds of things, and I honestly think it just has to do with ego, and I think a lot of it has to do also with, what's the word I'm looking for? Insecurity in a lot of coaches
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's...
Well, I think that coming from where you are, Tim, because you've done more probably in the fencing community than other coaches only dream of, because you've taught
yeah.
at acting schools, you've done stage combat, you've... done film, TV, you've coached celebrities, where most people, I think with you, it might be a lot of jealousy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with my world, yeah, there's a ton of jealousy because I've had kids come out of my school as far as competitive fencing. I've trained, you know, household name movie stars. Yeah, I don't have many friends outside of my studio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know. And I just wonder why, because I've opened my door to every single one of them, and they've all been there, all these other folks. But,
well,
you know.
Well, Tim, personally, coming from this standpoint, I know most people don't like you. That's why you don't have a lot of friends.
Well, it's... yeah, it could be that.
Oh,
too.
Man, I didn't even get a rim shot for that.
I was too busy laughing.
Okay.
Oh, here we go. There we go.
Okay.
Now you know Tim's in the same city as you, right? You remember
oh,
that,
yeah.
right, Bob?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh man.
Yeah, it's not like insulting you where you're a couple thousand miles away.
Yeah. Well, what about you guys, Cecil and Stephanie? Yeah, do you guys see like a separation, but do you guys see kind of like, you know, this, oh, my style's better than that style or the blah, blah, blah. Do you see that in classical or historical fencing?
Well, Rusty, I think the bigger issue here is that we're all people and we all have opinions, whether they're informed or not.
Mm-hmm.
And people typically write off when they look at anything, whether it's martial arts, people texting and walking down the street, or driving. Right, folks tend to want to see the differences instead of looking at the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's much like when you listen to music. Some folks listen to classical music, some folks listen to techno, jazz, and the first thing everyone wants to do is go, well, it's different.
Yeah.
But it's still music, and it has a particular science in mm-hmm. which music follows.
Mm-hmm.
And if more people looked at the bigger picture of martial arts, and that's sort of why you had sort of brought up the idea of this show,
mm-hmm.
is that there are far more similarities, no matter what differences we might see, if you're looking at the larger science.
Right, right. Definitely, I agree. Because, even within the Asian arts, we've got, you know, lots of like, and even within the same styles, you know, this dojo in Washington, you know, we're better than the dojo in New York or something like that, right? And it's sad to see, this type of, the only word I can think of is separation and thinking that, you know, that they are so much more different, or in some cases so much more better than even another dojo in their own system. I mean, you know, have you seen that before, Bob and Master Craig? Have you seen that in
your system? Oh, my God.
I know, right? And we call it politics.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and the politics is one of the reasons why I tend to shy away from, you know, big, huge organizations. The bigger an organization gets, I mean, if there's like a board of directors and stuff like that, not big as in like the number of practitioners, but if there's like a board of directors or something, then the bigger it gets, unless the board of directors, you know, has a nice, you know, rein on the behavior or whatever, then it could just go like completely, it'll turn into some big political cluster thing, you know, it's sad. It's sad to see that, and sometimes
it's really,
I wonder,
sad, Rusty, and God help it if the grandmaster passes away.
Exactly.
When Ed Parker died, oh my God, it went so many people tried to claim his system instead of it going to like Junior or somebody like that. It was just a mess.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we hear about that going on in the Kung Fu world too, where, you know, the grandmaster, you know, leaves his system to a trusted student that is not part of the family, and you know, even though the son is part of the family, but you know, doesn't have the same amount of skill or knowledge as the student that it was passed down to, and the son gets all upset, and all the supporters of the son gets all upset. And then it's like one big rigmarole when, you know, why is everyone fighting when the grandmaster himself chose the heir? You know, why,
right,
you know, discredit and disgrace your grandmaster by, you know, it's like fighting when someone dies and everyone's fighting over who gets the bank account and who gets the house and who gets the china. It's just so petty at that point. But yeah. But I found that, you know, just in the arts that I've been, that people tend to see more of the differences in other martial art. And when I say differences, I mean that, you know, some people will say, oh, that's different, therefore it's not as good, right? Or it's not, you know, the same as mine, therefore it's not as effective or whatever, right? And I tend to see that when a lot more when the practitioners are not of teacher status. So if they're not black belts in an Asian system, if they're like, let's say, maybe a purple belt or a brown belt or something like that, right, where they know enough, but not enough, you know what I mean? I find that that's when they tend to look at other arts and go, oh, well, that's, you know, that's different because, you know, they're only stuck in one world. They're like Cecil says, they're not looking at the big picture. And, you know, at least that's how I've noticed it in the arts that I've been. You know, they think that they're
well, and karate and you know Greg Wooldridge, and I agree with him that you shouldn't even have an opinion until you're black belt. I'm sorry. That's the way it is. Unless your teacher status, senpai, sensei, don't even talk to me.
Right.
That sounds very egotistical, but form your opinions when you know how to form an opinion, not when you're learning. And most of the things that you're talking about, Rusty, I'm sorry, what, Craig?
I said that's a dangerous one because I know a lot of black belts that shouldn't have opinions.
Yeah.
I know, that was an open-ended, right, and I agree with that. But, Rusty, most of the students that you're talking about have learned that from their instructors.
Exactly.
And that's why every show we talk about there are no egos here. Your egos are off somewhere else. We don't have those kind of problems here.
Yes. Yeah, and we're gonna make sure it keeps it that way.
Absolutely.
All right. So separation. And I've only met a few people that that would, you know, have an opinion about arts from other countries, like for example, like Krav Maga, right? I met some karate kid that, well, I shouldn't say kid, he was like 20 years old, but it's a kid, right? I met some karate kid that, you know, didn't quite understand. He just thought that the whole Krav Maga thing was like a bunch of hype and stuff, and that, you know, it's, you know, really not as it really, you know, not as effective as it's all cracked up to be. And I said, well, what makes you think that? Right. Well, and this is what I heard. One, because there is no historical culture. And two, there's no belt ranks. And I said, stop. Did you just say there's no belt ranks? This is what you're basing this on? You know, and again, it all boils down to, you know, if you're only, you know, exposed to just that one world and you don't understand either A, the other art, haven't researched it, you know, haven't tried it, only go by what you see on TV or something like that, then that opinion comes out because it's not your world, you know? So, and I had to leave that conversation pretty quick. I'm like, really? You're going to base your opinion on that because Krav Maga has no belt rank. Oh, okay. Can you believe that?
No,
yes.
I can't. That's
I believe someone would. Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy. Oh my gosh. So.
Well, it sounds like the issue is in that particular case. You have someone who perhaps has formed an opinion without all the information, because as we know, there are good instructors and there are poor instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And when you visit a school that has a poor instructor and you go, oh, well, they have belts, so therefore belts are of no value, then you don't have enough information. You are reaching a conclusion without enough information to actually go there because you're applying one specific situation to the larger world.
Exactly.
That's right. One thing, Rosie, you and I have talked about this. There are arts like Tai Chi, for example, that just started ranking systems.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hundreds of years old.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make it wrong?
And you know, in my head, no. But you'll be surprised at how many people will look at, like in the Wushu and Tai Chi system, they call it the Duan. Like, it's like Dan, right? So, like, instead of Dan, you know, it'd be like Yi Duan, you know, or Ar Duan, that kind of thing. You know, some of the huge traditionalists will look down on the Duan system mainly because they think that the only reason why the Dwen system has been put into place was for the young people. Well, I look at it this way. If the young people don't get into Tai Chi, then when all the rest of us old people, you know, get done, you know, when we finally leave this earth or whatever, what's going to be left, you know? No mm-hmm. Tai Chi, right? And you know, I forgot what the actual reason why the Dwen system got put into play. Oh, it's to make, if people are competing in Wushu, to make the Tai Chi divisions, how should we say, fair, so that way people that were of the same Dwen level would be competing against each other as opposed to, you know, some 20-year Tai Chi practitioner competing against some 2-year Tai Chi practitioner. So, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
You know, I do have to really interject here. Mm-hmm. It's examples like what started that whole thread there that caused a lot of the misnomers to martial arts because mm-hmm. they haven't even been around 200 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You know.
Yeah,
they came
only...
from Kano.
Yeah. Jigoro Kano, when he was teaching kids at a primary school, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I, you know, that's why I find it, I find it funny that, you know, like some people like that kid I was talking to, you know, base their, you know, traditional system on the fact that, you know, that it has belts, therefore it is bona fide as opposed to Krav Maga or even MMA and even vice versa. You know, I've met a lot of MMA people that will, you know, kind of go, oh, okay, you do Kaju Kenbo, oh, you do Tai Chi, huh, that's nice, but, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like, oh okay, well, whatever, it doesn't matter to me. So
yeah, it's really sad mm-hmm. when people, we like to call it knowing just enough to get in trouble.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, I was curious about something, the fencers. Because within martial arts, Master Greg Carter, Sifu Rusty, myself, we have all these titles, Sifu, Shifu, Shion, Senpai. Does the fencing world have those kind of designations?
Yes. There is, you have an instructor, and then from there, there's provost, and then master.
Well,
there's
also more than one fencing world.
Right.
Of course.
So you guys were, Cecil, you were talking about those particular title designations based on what?
Well, if you look at traditionally the fencing world, right, there were no ranks for students. You
mm-hmm.
you come in as a student and
right.
you are simply a student until one day you began to train to become an instructor,
mm-hmm.
and then from there, once you have then learned multiple weapons and proven your ability to teach those weapons before the fencing master, then
mm-hmm.
the next rank would be provost. And then from there, once you have showed your ability to teach at a higher level in the weapons that you're trained in, and then you would test for master. Or that's a short for Master of Arms.
Mm, mm-hmm. So that's a similarity between some of the Asian arts and the Western arts, you know, because technically, like
right.
Master Craig was mentioning, there were no belts, you know, back in the day. And if there was a belt, it was just to hold your trousers up. And, you know, and even then, if you were a teacher, and I'm just speaking from the Kung Fu side, there was no such thing as black belt. You were, you know, the shifu or the laoshir if you could fight and if your kung fu was good. And the community would dub you as an instructor. Would there be tests? Yeah, there'd be challenges from outside a village or something. They'd come in and go, oh, you know, I challenge your kun. Okay, so he's going to challenge the master of our kun. Okay, you know, and then if the master wins, then that the loser would publicly acknowledge that, and it would just make that person's notoriety and reputation grow as a great kung fu instructor. but you know, you just couldn't, like, you know, buy a black belt online and say I'm a teacher. So, you know, it's good to hear that there's like a similar, somewhat similar thing between the Asian and the historical fencing world. What about in the sport fencing, Tim? Is there like any type of like coach designation or anything, or?
No.
What are instructors called?
No, we don't have any kind of belt rankings and things like that, no, or any kind of ranking at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty much you are an instructor of fencing. You learn, you know, from the bottom up, and you just, it's more of, I think, with that kind of a, you know, prove yourself type of thing, like mm-hmm. it is in,
well,
like in competition. Well, you have rankings when you win.
Right.
Tournaments like A, B, C, D, E. So I that might be like a belt system, but the way to attain that is by actually going into a competition and winning. You can't become an A-ranked fencer just by training and training and training. You have to actually go out with your training and win. And you have to beat other A-ranked fencers you have to have so many. It's all a numbers thing. But that's the only way to get those rankings.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real governing body, but once you go out and win those competitions, you're recognized by the community, Tim, as an instructor or as an A-ranking fencer to become an instructor?
Not as an instructor, as an A-ranked fencer or a B or whatever. And then, as it goes, if you don't continue to fight, you lose it after 3 years.
Okay.
You win an A, for example, and at the end, on the anniversary of that, you know, of you winning it at the third-year anniversary, on the next day, you lose that ranking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something you don't, you know, it's not like you wear an A then on your jacket or anything. You just have it, and you know, everybody knows it's in the community, and when you compete, they do, because you kick their butt.
Right.
So it's,
well, now,
how it goes,
now,
yeah.
Now, Tim, you consider yourself a master fencer because you've been teaching and training for 30, 40 years. Is there a governing body that blesses that, or is it a self-proclaimed once you've been doing it and you're an expert out in your field, you're an instructor?
Yeah, I'm an instructor of fencing. It took me, you know, a long, long time before I you know, instructed, you know, before I started my own school and everything. You know, I taught for a long time before that and competed and everything else. And then it wasn't, you know, at a level. So it wasn't like there was any kind of governing body that says I have permission to be able to start my own club because of whatever. There's a lot of opinions about that, but like I said, my students beat other people's students who, you know, I don't know, were Olympians or something, you know. It makes no difference. It's the proof is on the strip. The proof is when you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you do it.
Bob, sit down. All right. There's actually a much closer similarity than you guys realize with the Asian arts, because traditional judo cannot progress without wins in the belt system.
Okay.
They must have wins starting at blue belt to progress. So it's very much driven the same as fencing, as you prove it or you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Totally agree with that system. I think more martial arts should do that. I think you'd have less talk and more doing, like you guys are talking about with all this.
Yeah.
Oh, my better than your thing, Mike. You know, whatever. And well, prove it. You know, let's get in the ring and prove it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's very interesting, Rusty.
I like the way that Cecil presented that. That is a very close similarity, at least in the judo arts.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, that, because it's like, and it's true. It's like, you know, the you know, in judo. I didn't know that about judo. I mean, because I've never
Neither
studied
did I.
Judo formally, right? You know, there used to be a time, though, in Kajukenbo where, you know, you could not get your black belt unless you fought out of the ring, meaning that, you know, you were surrounded by people who sold, you know, it was like getting jumped in, but you were trying to jump out.
Got it. Okay.
You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And, you know, yeah, you'd be injured and wouldn't be able to walk for a week or something like that, you know, but, you know, once you wore that black belt, everyone knew that you know your stuff and that you can fight. And that it can be proven. Now, I can't train my students like that anymore. But, you know, it's, you know, that was just the way it was, at least in that art. And even then, I wouldn't, you know, really consider Kajukenbo to be traditional. Is it an amalgam of Asian arts? Yes, it is. But, you know, it's considered to be a eclectic martial arts. And that's what they wanted it for. They wanted it for the street. They wanted it for, you know, is it going to work? And, you know, what if a judo guy comes up against you? What are you going to do? You know, you can't grapple with him unless you know how to grapple, you know. What are you going to do? So, and it, you know, and I found that interesting. And, boy, am I glad that I didn't have to get jumped out for my black belt.
And, you know, Rusty, there are some people that do some weird tests for their black belt. I know... Shidoshi Frank Dukes, I love the guy, but he actually has you jump and roll out of a car back doing 60 miles an hour out of a pickup truck.
Okay, wait, so you're driving down the road, right, and it's going 60 miles an hour and you're supposed to jump out?
Yes.
And not get hurt?
I didn't say that.
So let me ask you this, Bob. If I tell you no, do I get master ranking because I'm wise?
You should.
I know. I would have given you a black belt for that because you got to be wise.
I mean, I'm not jumping out of any cars.
Yeah.
No.
Hey, you're ready for...
Hey, Craig, I have a question for you.
Oh, no.
Craig, I have a question for you. On the taekwondo line, let me read it here. Why? Because most arts don't kick like you guys, because it's like 70% kicks. Why? Tell me the history, and why were the high kicks so prevalent?
Well, the high kicks are more frequently used, but to say there's 70% of it is actually quite a misnomer. There's quite a bit of hand techniques in traditional predecessory arts to Taekwondo. But Taekwondo, in a drive to become an Olympic sport, was pushed heavily into showcasing its signature, which are the head-level kicks. Mm-hmm. Head-level kicks and the flying kicks or jumping kicks were primarily used because Koreans didn't have horses and samurais did. Mm-hmm. And they were used to dismount the samurais.
Okay, that was the story I heard, and I wasn't sure how close that was. And
that's
what I understood, the jumping.
That is the most accurate story taken from the history of many, many different debates.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
That is cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about training. Let's talk more about training methods and stuff like that, so that way our listeners can get a feel for, you know, what is, you know, similar between our arts. Okay. So, listeners, our number here is 347-677-0699. Feel free to call in. It's a very, very informative discussion on the differences and similarities between Eastern and Western martial arts. If you're listening, and I know that there are people out there listening, if you know anyone that's on our guest thing, I know there are people out there listening, feel free to call in. Don't be shy. 347-677-0699. All right. So let's talk a little bit about training. So let's just say, let's pretend that a new student that has no experience in any of your arts walks into your school, boom. What would be their beginning lessons? How would that start? Why don't we start with Tim and go to Cecil and Steph, and then we'll go to Craig. So we'll start with Tim. What would a newbie learn at your
school? A newbie would come in, and the first thing you're taught is balance, how it balances out, and the correct stance to keep a center balance, 50-50 both sides, and why that's important with this particular fighting style. You'd learn how to go backward, called retreat. You'd learn how to go forward, called advance. You'd learn what a strong, long attack is, and that's called a lunge. There's different types of attack, footwork attack things, but that's all they learn in the first lesson.
Okay.
They'd learn, they'd be told a little bit about each one of the three Olympic weapons, foil, saber, and épée, and a little bit about the different, they're all swords, but they're all different weapons in the way that they're judged and in the way that they move, and the areas and different things like that. And then they'd move back and forth. There's a couple different exercises we do with them, and then we actually let them put on the stuff and sort of hack at each other. And most of the people that come in are recreational, and in my school I like to start it that way because, that's what they want to come in, and they want to learn how to do it. And it comes a certain point in a person's, life, I guess, when they decide they want to compete. And there's no in forcing them into being competitors first lesson on. That's my philosophy in it. And we've had, obviously, they start out that way, adults, kids, it doesn't matter. And then we've had a lot of them to go into competition, and a lot of them, to get scholarships to universities and everything else from it. So it works out real well.
That's very
not
cool.
How everybody
very
does
cool.
It.
That is very cool. And let's go to Cecil and Stephanie. What would a newbie learn when they first walk into the cell?
Well, I'm sure that Tim and I have some very similar things that we are teaching new students as they come in. But being a very traditional school, it's not particularly exciting because what you're doing, traditionally people would go to learn to fence. Potentially in preparation for a serious encounter that would be a duel with sharp weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of we keep that mentality in our training, and when a new student comes in, they spend a good part of time developing particular muscle groups through exercises, and more importantly, developing proper posture, because from your guard position, as in all martial arts, your guard position is the position in which both your offense and defense will stem from. And if your guard position is designed to facilitate those actions, and if you cannot form the proper position and move in that position efficiently, then everything else from that becomes very inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
So new students spend a lot of time developing that ability and the placement of posture and moving fluidly. And then from there, they start to learn how to manipulate the particular fencing weapon. And everyone starts with the foil. Well, the foil was never a weapon. The foil was always a training tool to learn to use the actual sword of the day.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And as a student, we're going to talk to Steph here. On your first day, how did you feel that first day? Coming into a class, not exactly knowing what to expect.
Well, Cecil somewhat downplays some of the charm of what he's teaching. There's still very much a lot of attention given to the overall what you're ultimately trying to achieve. I mean, there's a romanticism for a lot of people who come to fencing, and what's most infectious for me from certain instructors is getting infected by their enthusiasm for the totality of the art that they're wanting to teach you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get that the first day and then it continues and you're constantly be giving not just physical but intellectual things that your mind can percolate on throughout the whole week, it just gives you more reason to want to come back and look forward to something, especially when you give them the impression that there's so much information there that you have a lifetime worth of learning, and it's not mm-hmm. just, it's not just something that's a quick fix. It's something that you can, you know, really enjoy for your life.
Awesome. Very cool. Let's move on to Master Craig. Master Craig, what would a new student expect at your school, their first few lessons?
Oh, wow. That's actually a complex question because it has to do with age as well as anything else.
That's true. Because at your school, you teach kids as well as adults. Kids, teens, the whole nine yards, right? Kids, teens, adults.
Adults, military, law enforcement. We run the gamut. And we'll just take the most typical student, say a nine-year-old child.
Okay.
Would learn movement. I think the similarities would pretty much cross the board.
Yeah.
For the most part, our weapons come later, and our bodies are our weapons starting out.
Mm-hmm.
But we start to teach them through mimicking techniques where they follow mm-hmm. along. Until their body develops the natural coordination to move in the odd ways that we move.
Mm-hmm.
And then we actually progress into educating them on what they're learning, which is kinetic linking.
Mm-hmm.
And such as with fencing, it is the foundation for everything. You can move on the fly, but somebody who really understands it knows that you're linking and you're maintaining balance and control and posture while you're doing it.
Right. That takes me back to, the classes that, you know, I've been in. I mean, like the first day I did wushu. Now, this is even after, like, you know, 20 years of martial arts experience. You know, I come in, do my first wushu class with Master Hong, and the first thing we do is horse stance. She said,
yep.
Ma Bu, and I went, oh boy, here we go. You know what I mean? And, you know, and in my head I'm thinking, well, this is wushu. This is like modern, contemporary wushu. But we were in horse stance, and we were doing basics for 2 hours. Just basics, you know, and with her counting them out and doing them over and over again and coming to each student and, like, correcting them physically, you know, moving their fists or moving their legs and stuff, and I was like, wow, this is really something. Now, several people quit after that first lesson because
yep.
I think people were looking for, you know, like Stephanie mentioned, that quick fix. They were looking for that. Oh, I want to be Jet Li. I want to be like Jackie Chan, and we're in a horse stance, you know, and we're doing punches and palm strikes and, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, where's the butterfly kicks? Where's the acrobatics? And,
I've actually had a parent use that line on me after 3 weeks of class with their six-year-old child.
Uh-huh.
They quit, and I quote, they said, my child isn't a Power Ranger yet, so we're going to go to a different school.
Really?
Yes.
He wants to be the Blue Ranger, so we're going to go to a different school. I've gotten that, too. I've had kids that quit. I had this one child that quit at he was going to be a purple belt, but he quit before that. It was just that, you know, he wasn't showing up to class, and when he did show up to class, his performance was substandard. You know, he was interrupting class a lot, you know, just not behaving correctly and doing a lot of push-ups because he wasn't behaving. And I put out the latest test roster, and his name wasn't on it. And I got this nasty phone call from his mom. Well, I don't see why, you know, I'm going to make up a name. I don't see why Johnny isn't testing for his purple belt. And I said, well, he hasn't been showing up to class. And he says he did. He's been showing up to class, and he says that, you know, you're putting him in a horse stance for no reason and this and that and the other. And, well, if you're not going to promote him, then we're going to go to a different dojo. And I said, well, you know, how much martial arts experience do you have? Well, none. I'm like, well, then I'm the only one that can promote him, and you really don't have a say. And
I was actually learned right off the bat that they have to be signed off by their floor instructor, as in allowable to test, and then that has
yeah.
to be approved up the chain before
yeah.
they even chance. So everybody knows with us right off the bat that you don't test every time there's a testing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and apparently some people, like, forget that. And it's like, oh, my God.
It's because of, I won't name them, but it's because of the Take My Dough schools out there that like to sign you up for 24.
I just got that. Take My Dough.
Yeah, they like to sign people up for 24-month black belt contracts with automatic withdrawals or your money back.
Right.
How many people do you think don't reach black belt in those schools?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Because that's crazy. And when he did quit, because he quit, he was like, you know, he didn't want to wait 7 years for a black belt. And he came back a year later just to say hello. You know, and, you know, of course, his classmates, you know, have come up a few ranks and stuff like that. But he comes in, you know, with a taekwondo, you know, gi. And I think he went to, like, some chain that was Take My Dough. And
yep.
He got his black belt in a year. And he came in wearing his black belt. And I went, what are you doing? You can't wear that in here. You're not ranked in Butokukan like that. And it was just like, oh. And I guess he just wanted to come in and gloat about, you know, about he's a black belt and all his classmates, he's way over them now and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, go and punch one of them.
Yeah, we have a quick fix for that. We welcome anybody to wear whatever belt they've earned. But when they come back to visit us and they've earned a much higher belt, that automatically becomes a sparring night.
Exactly.
Well, Rusty, years and years ago, I had this student come in, wanted to take kickboxing from me. Her sister was a very prominent actress on TV with an old show that was done by Margaret Cho, American Girl. She was a little girl in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was, she came in, she says, well, I've studied kickboxing now, but it's way down in Hollywood. I want to my closer. She's only a few blocks away. So I'm teaching how to jab, how to cross. She says, wow, and my other kickboxing school, the instructor is teaching us how to throw Chinese stars.
Oh.
And I'm like, what? So there's a lot of instructors that will cater to the young people that they want to throw stars, they want to do different things. Well, then don't come to me and say you're learning how to kickbox, because you're not.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now in the fencing world, you know, like, you know, martial arts instructors in the Asian martial arts, if we do teach kids, then you know, we start them pretty young. I mean, I start them at like around 3 years old. I don't know how old Master Craig does, but I started him at three. I mean, granted, it's not martial arts at that point. It's basically, you know, do you know your right from your left, you know, type of stuff, you know, coordination.
Right, sure.
Right. But is it, you know, in fencing, is there like a minimum age that you guys have for kids?
I start them at seven. Seven seems to be where they it's not Peter Pan anymore.
Right.
Anything before that, they're just not mentally ready for it. You know, also their muscles haven't formed as well. I don't know, something happens at seven that's different.
Yeah.
And they're ready to understand what, you know, different attacks and defenses and patience and stuff like that is. But and to understand that, you know, it's not Peter Pan.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, right. Or something.
That actually fits beautifully with some of the research we've done. We found that the frontal cortex doesn't develop enough to process and then regurgitate, so to speak, a technique until age six, because they really don't understand it. They're only trying to follow along. And by adding a tool to the problem, that would explain the other year for the fencers.
Mm-hmm.
That would be right on the money. So I totally agree. We don't start students unless it's until age six.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
usually
I don't start.
At 6 year olds, it's usually the girls that will understand it before the boys. The boys are around seven. You know, the girls, I've got a girl right now. She's going to, what school is she going to? Some wonderful university in East Coast. And she started with me when she was six, and now she's got a full scholarship to, I forget the school. It wasn't like Harvard or Yale or something, but it was Northwestern or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, full fencing scholarship, and she started when she was six. So,
wow. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. That's very cool. Good for her.
Yeah. Scholarship. Absolutely. I didn't know that there were scholarships for fencing. That is so cool. That is neat.
Yeah.
So what I've heard so far as, you know, what people learn when they first walk into the studio is it boils down to basics. It boils down to your feet, your footwork, your basics of footwork, where your center of gravity is and your proprioception and your ability to be aware of how your body moves in space. And that's an important similarity, because many people tend to look only at technique. Right? Like, my sidekick's different from that sidekick, or, you know, that kind of thing. Or this style of thrust is different than that style of thrust and that other style of fencing. And, you know, a lot of times people tend to look at technique only, as opposed to looking at, you know, what's important. I mean, technique is useless at that point if we don't concentrate on what's important, right? I mean, in this case, it would be balance. It would be your stance. It would be your footwork, your ability to move effectively and freely and efficiently. So it's great that all of you put that out there, that it was all about basics. And in a lot of cases, not only physical stamina for the classes, but mental stamina, right? I mean, for the Western martial arts, is there do you guys tend to, do you guys tend to repeat something so much over and over again that it's almost like a weeding out type of a thing with some students, as it is like in the Chinese arts and in a lot of, I'm speaking about, Chinese and the very few Japanese arts that I've been in, is that, you know, we're very hip on repetition. You know, we believe that, well, you can't get good at it unless you repeat it over and over and over again. It doesn't matter that you academically know it. It doesn't matter that your body is familiar with it. We're going to keep repeating this until you have it down pat. And a lot of people will quit because they don't feel like they're progressing enough. Is there something similar like that in the Western arts?
Well, Rashida, and yeah, of course there's repetition. It's how people learn is through repetition itself.
Mm-hmm.
But
of course,
learning any martial science, it's a lifetime endeavor. And certainly with all the colors you have on the phones here, everyone's been doing this for a very long time. And how we do things now, it's certainly not exactly the way we performed things 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
As in everyone's practice, it's a continual level of refinement to
right.
improve your own understanding of your physicality and intellectually understanding on top of that. And that comes through repetition. So the repetition isn't a weeding out process. It's making someone understand through physical movement what they have to achieve and the many levels of wrongness and the one right way they should be doing it for what they're trying to learn at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I shouldn't say, you know, that you guys would be weeding people out, but the students themselves would weed themselves out, because, you know, it used to be a common practice that, you know, you walk into a kung fu school and the first thing they do is put you in mabu or the horse stance, and they would leave you there. And a lot of times the actual master would not teach you. It would be a senior student, and you're left there wondering, why am I in this stupid horse stance? Why am I learning from the master? Why are we just doing punches for a year? In fact, there is a school out here in Seattle that is known affectionately for that you're in a horse stance for a year. And then if you're still there after a year, then Sifu talks to you and will teach you. And then by that point in time, those students are very, very strong and, you know, indomitable spirit, everything, you know, whereas the people that do, you know, quit after 2 weeks and flit about, you know, they weed themselves out. But yeah, you know, I completely agree with the repetition. It's the only way to get good at anything. Would everyone else would agree? I would assume.
I have a kid right now I'm teaching that's blind, and try to imagine being blind and learning with a sword. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough. But this kid, he's only been at it a short time, actually, and he doesn't have the handicap of seeing. And so what he does, his attacks, and I'll have to cue him on attacks, but it's perfect. Because mm-hmm. what he's learned is not to do it with his eyes. He has to learn everything with how it feels mm-hmm. and trust. And so he's got to trust me, obviously, that I have to take him to the right point. And then as soon as he's doing the things and he does them technically correct, he's hitting the mark every single time. It's amazing to see. Mm-hmm. The person that, you know, has these handicaps of, well, we'll say sight in this case, mm-hmm. What they're doing is they have preconceived opinions mm-hmm. as to how they should look, and it's very difficult to, in some cases, to have them see that what they're doing is incorrect. You know, mm-hmm. I agree with definitely that you have to have repetition, and it's not always that easy, as you all know.
Right.
Student is wired the way people are wired. But I mm-hmm. can tell you, you know, you saw this kid doing it, you'd be, and I'm sure that others that couldn't see would just be, you know, they do the same thing over and over again because that's all they got.
Yeah.
It's a defense mechanism that they get sucked into, and we call it getting one track roaded. They mm-hmm. they don't learn to feel, and if they can't feel, they think they're doing it right because they look in a mirror, and it just, the technique is not there.
Right. I really like how you put that, Tim, to be limited by sight. And it's true. I had this discussion with one of my senior students who's training to become a teacher. I was telling her about, you know, certain things, you know, to look for when teaching, and, you know, and one of them was, I told her, you know, many students will think they're doing it right, so they won't give you that energy that says, am I doing this right? They won't give you that questioning energy, so you won't pick up on that, and you probably will fall into this lull to where you think, well, they're not asking questions, so that must mean they understand it pretty well. Let's move on. And I told her, you have to keep an eye on them because they think they're doing it right, and they're trying so hard to imitate their interpretation of what you're doing, and
right.
it's just not going to be there. And I told her, you know, try not to put yourself into that false sense of security that if they don't ask questions, that they got it, because, you know, it's going to just set up a railroad of, you know, bad habits, and it's going to be hard for us to get them back on track at that point. So
you think about it, like in foil, that weapon, small sword, it was the only thing faster than a foil point is a bullet. And mm-hmm. so if you're trying to pick that up from 3 feet away, three steps away, mm-hmm. you can't rely on your eyes. You know, I mean, you can see it coming, that they're mm-hmm. useful. Your eyes are useful. But if you try to analyze that attack mm-hmm. while it's coming at you, you're certainly going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're stuck. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's better to, you know, the body. I always talk about the body and the brain having two different brains. They call it the human brain and the horse brain.
Mm-hmm.
And the horse takes itself. It's a reactionary brain in your body that once you understand and learn and are disciplined with the correct techniques and everything, that it can react correctly. The human brain analyzes things like movement and what I'm looking for and how can I get this person into a situation where I can have the best advantage over them. And
right.
then once the human brain does its job, it needs to learn to shut off and let the horse brain take over with the discipline
mm-hmm.
and everything it's learned. And that's very difficult for people to separate those two. I'm
yeah.
sure it's the same in Eastern as it is in Western.
I would say so. Go ahead,
yeah,
Craig.
It's fight psychology. You can't process what you're going to do physically and read your opponent at the same time.
Yeah.
So
right.
you have
yeah.
to train until it becomes reactionary. Then once your body knows how to react naturally, you can assess what your opponent's doing. And that we teach the same way.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
And then to accept that is another thing. If you make a block, we call it a parry, but, you know, with you, it'd be a block, I do believe, correct me, please, if I'm wrong. Maybe if you were to block somebody for the first time and you didn't analyze it with your brain, that you actually did it reactionary, the response, the riposte to that is probably non-existent because they go, what the hell, I just did it. You know? Accept that. I can't accept that. My brain, it just can't accept it. So, you get that, and then there's another, you know, at least you've gotten to one point, now you can start on the next level, having to respond to what they've done.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I very frequently stop class dead in their tracks when I see somebody nail something perfect. I make them stop, think about it, and remember how that felt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I make a point of telling them to remember how that felt.
Yeah.
Good.
That's exactly it, how it feels. And, you know, being from an internal arts background too, the term feel is very important to me, because it's like, you know, we talk about how sight can fool us, our own minds can fool us. The level of sensitivity that has to be, you know, from your arm to your foil or your saber or your épée or your dusak or whatever you have, right? It's got to be there. And I would imagine it's got to be trained in such a way that it happens when it has to. And, you know, depending on the art, it will look good when it has to, while you're doing it. Now, some arts, you know, aren't worried about, you know, is it going to look picture perfect, right? Is it going to be effective? But regardless, what did you call it, Tim? The horse brain? the more primitive brains that react. If there's anything that's very similar between Eastern and Western martial arts, it's the road to get to that goal of, you know, pure reaction, and to move without thinking, and to apply without, you know, overanalyzing while it's happening. The more that we talk about this stuff, you know, the more I hope our listeners, you know, can see, you know, deeper into the martial arts and to really see the big picture, as Cecil put it, that there really is only so many ways, you know, the body can move. And even with, you know, the Eastern systems that do have, we have sword play too. And, you know, it's not all that different. I mean, I know nothing about historical and classical fencing. I know nothing of sport fencing.
But you do know something about martial arts.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Again,
you understand
the bigger elements.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that would be a great asset if I were to decide to, you know, pursue, you know, a Western martial arts. Now, Bob, tell everyone your story about the fencing competition. Real quick.
Well,
we have 10 minutes.
It was funny because Rusty's heard the story a couple times. I don't know if you remember this, Tim. About 20 years ago, you had a saber tournament in your school.
Uh-huh.
I took one saber lesson from you privately.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, you know, this looks a little bit similar to my stick work, because I was heavy duty to stick fighting at that time. And we had probably 20 seasoned saber fencers. They'd been fencing saber for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the competition very open-minded, thinking I'm just going to get my butt kicked.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are all good. I came in fourth out of 20 seasoned saber fencers. In fact, there was one guy that was so frustrated by me, he at point five, he dropped his weapon.
Oh, no.
So I could hit him.
Wow.
Because
maybe just,
all I was doing was, what I was doing, Tim, was just what we call a redondo, which means round. I was just breaking my wrist and snapping it. And then running into it. Now, the reason I lost is there were some very good saber fencers that were just quicker than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow,
I guess our point is that was a similarity from what I was doing and from the role that the saber took. It's just mm-hmm. extension of the hand. And since I was already using a stick with the same targets, it was an unbelievable experience I'll never forget.
Yeah.
Well, saber fencers are more Neanderthal anyway, Bob, so that's why I know you chose that weapon.
Oh, yeah. What's that old term? Oh, yeah, fight me.
As we know,
no, I don't remember, but forgive me, but that right there should tell you a lot of the similarities. Bob just did what he knew, and he was very successful at it, and probably had, with the martial arts training, the focus and the mental stuff, had a good shot, obviously, did very well.
Whoops, sorry. I'm like pushing buttons on accident here. Sorry.
Well, it was funny what we were talking about repetition, Rusty, is that mm-hmm. one thing Bruce Lee said is he's not afraid of the guy who does 10,000 different kicks one time. He's afraid mm-hmm. of the guy that does one kick 10,000 times.
Exactly. Exactly. And your story, Bob, is a good example of being able to take martial theory and martial principle and apply it to a different weapon while learning the different nuance of the other weapon. That, you know, that shows that someone understands martial principle and that every, you know, all the other styles are just the only thing that's different really are the countries they come from, the flavor, the terminology, the nuance, the, you know, that kind of thing. And because, like, I remember one time, I don't know if you remember, Cecil, I don't remember where we were because I think we had a few beers, but I remember you teaching me, like, Dusak or something, right? And I'm like, wait a minute, this is exactly like a lot of my Largo Mano type of work. This is incredible, the stance, the angulation, the technique, this is cool. And I think we were at it for, I don't know what, half an hour?
Yeah.
And it was really cool how very similar and how natural the weapon felt in comparison to a stick or, let's say, maybe a kampilan or a bolo, which are Filipino weapons, you know. And I was like, wow, see, there's so many similarities that it was like almost unbelievable. It was really, really cool. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that because the key is in all the arts, when you're looking to maintain your defense from being hit by something or someone, mm-hmm. you have to look at the angulation of you versus your adversary, their motions, their movement, the time of their movement, and how you work in time with them. And all of this that everyone is learning in the various arts, that they're learning them properly, helps them see the bigger science in the martial arts.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Now, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we only have about 6 minutes. But before we go, would there be any possibility, because I want to have a part two on this, would there be any possibility on getting any or all of you on again for possibly a part two to this discussion?
Well, yeah. Just be in touch and see what we can figure out.
Very cool. Awesome. Now, real quick before everyone goes, because we have listeners from all over the country or even people that might be, you know, visiting the California area and the Pacific Northwest, how do we get a hold of everyone? So if anyone's interested in coming to your studio, Tim, how do we get a hold of you?
Would you like the website, the phone number?
Sure.
Both?
Website.
Okay, yeah, well, the website is swordplayla.com.
Okay.
That's the website for the fencing, and then I have a theatrical website as well called fights2film.com, mm-hmm. fights2film.com. And then our phone number at the studio is 818-56-1777.
So that's 818-5. Can you repeat the number again? 818-566. 566, okay.
1-877.
All righty, cool. And Master Craig, what's the website for you, please?
Well, you can find us at www.pureforcemartialarts. That's P-U-R-E.
Mm-hmm.
And we're currently under development on it, so you can go to the contact page and hit us through email there.
Okay.
But we're redeveloping some of our areas of focus and addressing some of the concerns of some less experienced people. You know, the typical
mm-hmm.
office worker that wants to get out and explore more disaster preparedness type
mm-hmm.
scenario. So as we go through our development stage, you'll see a lot of updating on our website. Bear with us, please.
Okay. No problem.
Oh,
and
cool.
Cecil and Stephanie, how do we get a hold of you guys?
Right, keeping it simple, SeattleClassicalFencing.com.
Mm-hmm. SeattleClassicalFencing.com. Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for joining me and Sifu Bob for this particular discussion. The 2 hours went by really quick.
We only heard back from Cecil on if they join us again for a part two. We didn't hear back from Craig, Stephanie, or Tim.
No, I said yeah, that's fine.
Awesome.
Bob,
yeah.
Bob, your hearing go with your hair.
Craig, you up for that? another bite me. Yeah. No, I had a great time. This was a very this was an amazing show.
Yeah, it was great, and you know, in the 2 hours. You know, after we got done with the news and stuff, I thought, oh, we have a whole hour. This will be for an hour and 15 minutes, actually. More like an hour and 20. I thought, oh, we got plenty of time. And then all of a sudden, I look up at the clock, and I'm like, what do you mean we've only got a couple minutes left? What's going on? So definitely let's do a part two on this. And so, yeah, listeners, you know, we'll do another part two on this. If you haven't yet become a member on the Dynamic Dojo radio show group page on Facebook, please sign up for that because you'll get all the news and happenings for upcoming episodes and stuff like that.
And I want to interject something real quick, Rusty.
Sure.
I want to wish everybody a happy holiday. This is our last show before Christmas, and
mm-hmm.
I hope everybody enjoys the time with their family and enjoys this time of year.
For real, yes. Yes,
thanks,
for sure.
Bob.
Yeah, so thank you, Master Craig and Tim and Cecil and Steph. Listeners, join us next week as we welcome Soke, Greg Woldridge to the show. He just returned from a world tour of studying all over Philippines, Malaysia, Israel, where all these other places. Don't want to miss that show and hear about his exploits. So, until next week, thank you all very much, and we'll see everybody next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
Take care, guys.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Ho, 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 ho.